everyone, and welcome to At the Boundary, the podcast from the Global and National Security Institute at the University of South Florida. I'm Jim Cardoso, Senior Director for GNSI and your host of At the Boundary. In December 2022, at the 6th Great Power Competition Conference, USF hosted Ambassador Marshall Billingsley, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute and former Special Presidential Envoy. Ambassador Billingsley discussed Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its impact on the Middle East and Southwest Asia, known as the Central Region. As we record this podcast a year after his comments and almost 2 years after the invasion, his insights remain as relevant as ever. Ambassador Billingsley argued unequivocally for continuation of military and financial support to Ukraine for its defense against Russia and delved into Russian reactions if the war ground on for an extended time, which, as we've seen, it has. He also looked at China's future actions based on lessons learned from the Ukraine invasion, as well as what Iran and its terror proxies might gain from any Russian success in Ukraine. Here are Ambassador Billingsley's remarks at the 6th Great Power Competition Conference.
And thanks to the University of South Florida for hosting this conference on such an important and timely topic, as well as to U.S. Central Command for being here with us. And it's great to see General McKenzie again and to see General Carrillo this morning, the two fantastic officers I've had a chance to work with over the years. And U.S. CENTCOM and the nation are certainly lucky to have them. I also want to thank at the outset of my remarks Elon Musk and his new artificial intelligence platform, ChatGPT, because last night I went ahead and tasked it with auto-generating the rest of this speech. Work smarter, not harder, right? No, seriously, this thing is the rage on Twitter. People are saying it spells the end of term papers in college. It can instantly write a 300-word short story on Bill Clinton getting into a fistfight with Niccolo Machiavelli, or an Atlantis Morissette song about trading Victor Boot for Brittany Griner. Isn't it ironic? So why not task it to brainstorm on the implications for the Middle East from Russia's war against Ukraine? But I will tell you, because I actually tried to do this just to see what would happen, the machine wanted nothing to do with this topic. It threw up multiple objections. It said its data hadn't been refreshed since 2021, no way to connect to the internet to get additional information, and it didn't want to comment on current events. Basically, the AI was saying, this is a really complicated topic. It involves high stakes, probably going to get it wrong, and I don't really want to have anything to do with it. So hard pass. So without the benefit of artificial intelligence, what you're getting this afternoon is whatever of mine I can offer. So set your expectations accordingly. I'm going to talk to you about four things. The first is why it's important that we keep arming Ukraine to defeat the Russians. The second is what Russia will likely do in the CENTCOM AOR as the war grinds on. The third is likewise for China as they watch Ukraine and they plan for their own conquest of Taiwan. And time allowing to get to how Iran and its terror proxies factor into all of this. First, let me say, this is a debate that is raging now in Washington, particularly within my party. So here I'm speaking also to the young students of USF. This is something that we must stick with, arming the Ukrainians. Make no mistake, arming a friendly, freedom-loving nation to defeat a massive and unprovoked Russian invasion is a quintessentially American thing to do. Ronald Reagan did it to the Soviets in Afghanistan, so bloodying the Red Army that they finally admitted defeat and withdrew. In his 1985 speech, State of the Union address, President Reagan articulated what became known as the Reagan Doctrine. He cautioned against passivity when liberty is under assault. And he urged the American people that, quote, we must not break faith with those who are risking their lives to defy Soviet-supported aggression and secure rights which have been ours from birth, unquote. All told, Reagan spent around $3 billion to bleed the Red Army white in Afghanistan. If you adjust for today's dollars, that's around $11 billion. Of course, the scale and intensity of what's happening in Ukraine dwarfs what was going on in Afghanistan, and so too will be the sums necessary to defeat Russia this time around. To date, we've supplied approximately $17 billion to the Ukrainians in actual military hardware, and I believe we certainly can and should do more. There's a great deal of confusion because of how the Biden administration is double, triple, sometimes quadruple counting these numbers, these various press releases, because they're not only including that $17 billion I mentioned, but they're also including the cost of replenishment. They're including the cost of actually getting our defense industrial base back to where it needs to be to manufacture these weapons, things like Stingers and Javelins, all these things you've heard of. We've also created a slightly over $10 billion fund that Ukraine can use to buy weapons from American manufacturers. And then there are similar amounts that are being provided in terms of humanitarian assistance because Russia has wiped out half of Ukraine's GDP and people are freezing to death, as well as funds to keep the Ukrainian government operating on a day-to-day basis. So when you add up what the Biden administration has asked for, it's not trivial. It's about $105 billion if you add the most recent amounts they've asked for from the Congress, which many in my own party are having a hard time reconciling. But I must say that while the sums are not trivial, the results that the Ukrainians have had are also not trivial. Ukraine has used our equipment and that from our NATO allies to devastating effect on the Russians. According to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Russia has suffered more than 100,000 casualties so far. To put it in context, during the first 9 months of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or reinvasion of Ukraine, they have had more soldiers killed than in 9 years of their invasion of Afghanistan. This is simply not sustainable for the Russian military. And you can see the results on the battlefield as they retreat from city after city. If we stay the course, if we stand by the Ukrainian people, Russia will lose this war too. Every $175,000 Javelin or $120,000 Stinger that we provide to the Ukrainians that knocks out a $4 or $20 million tank or helicopter or combat aircraft, that translates into a decimated Russian military that not only will be incapable of winning in Ukraine, but it actually won't be able to threaten our NATO allies for decades to come if we do this correctly. Now, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry provides their claims over how many different weapon systems have been eliminated, and they claim to have killed 3,000 tanks and nearly 6,000 armored combat vehicles. Even if these numbers are inflated twofold, the attrition and the devastation being wreaked on the Russian military is clearly significant. And it's in this context that I remind everybody, our students, my Republican colleagues, as Reagan said in his State of the Union address, quote, dollar for dollar, security assistance contributes as much to global security as our own defense budget, unquote. We got to keep that in mind. Moreover, with Chinese communist aggression against Taiwan appearing ever more likely, the sooner we drive the Russian bear back into its cave to lick its wounds, the better. So I think we need to remind ourselves of what a true American foreign policy in this context looks like. It is not isolationist. It does not abandon freedom-loving peoples. It does not throw a lifeline to a drowning enemy. It tosses them an anchor. So if I then turn to how I believe this is going to unfold, Russia's not backing down and shows no signs of being willing to do so. And a big part of their counter to what we and our allies are doing, in fact, involves the CENTCOM AOR. Let's start on the economic side with export controls and sanctions. Some of the trade restrictions imposed by the United States, by Europe, and some of our Asian allies are starting to bite. Russia is expending huge volumes of ordnance in this fight, and they're suffering these battlefield losses I mentioned. Simply put, they just don't have the production infrastructure necessary to replenish without access to a lot of Western technology and components. So they can't get these technologies, and we're starting to see some important bottlenecks in Russian supply chains emerge, particularly for their precision-guided munitions. Now, this makes jurisdictions such as the United Arab Emirates, with its free trade zones, very attractive to the Russian intelligence services. The SVR, which is its external intelligence service, inherited from the KGB, a special line of officers who are trained and specialize in evading export controls. They understand how to establish the commercial footprint that is needed to acquire dual-use technology for seemingly legitimate purposes. Dubai has long been a hub for this type of activity, often used by Iran, China, North Korea. Look for the Russian presence to expand there. In terms of sanctions, while the Russian economy really hasn't felt a major shock due to the Biden administration's unwillingness to truly target the oil sector, or the gas trade, or the associated banks, Russia is nevertheless planning for that eventuality. The recent EU price cap is largely performance art. They set it at $60 a barrel when Russian Urals is trading at 57. Moreover, it doesn't even touch pipeline oil, which is what's going to Hungary and to Germany and others. And it doesn't begin to really degrade the hard currency reserves that the Central Bank of Russia has built up. But they are planning, and they are beginning to put in motion the deceptive practices necessary to evade a truly meaningful set of sanctions on oil. And General, you and I have seen this firsthand with how the Iranians did it. The Russians are operating off of that playbook. The same kinds of tools and techniques, tricks that the Venezuelans and the Iranians and the North Koreans use are what we're now seeing the Russians use. In fact, a number of vessels that were previously being used by the Iranians to smuggle oil are now in Russian service. And we're seeing them go dark, turn off their AIS beacons. They're bunkering in the same places that the Iranians bunker, off of the Herd Bank, which is just outside Maltese territorial waters, for instance. Those vessels are eventually going to head east through the Suez and around Yemen and onwards to India and China. And I will tell you, Admiral, this is your bailiwick, and I'm really glad to see we got a, by the way, go Navy, beat Army. But maritime interdiction is going to become an even more important mission for CENTCOM, and I do hope that you and NAVCENT are going to be given the resources and the authorities necessary to get at this Russian problem. You see, unless we start making a real dent in Russia's hard currency generation through these energy exports, they will prolong this war and potentially for years. I want that to sink in. The Europeans today are sending every single day more than $500 million in oil and gas purchases to Moscow. And India and China have stepped in to pick up what's left. So assuming we do begin to have a financial impact, a real financial impact, the illicit off-the-books revenue generation of other Russian activities is going to become ever more important. And this again falls within CENTCOM's remit as well as AFRICOM's. Let me give you an example. Certain of the Russian oligarchs, like Yevgeny Prigozhin, who runs the Wagner Group, are really mattering to Putin, not only because of what they're doing on the ground in Ukraine, with all the convicts that they rounded out of the Russian prisons and mobilized. But the Wagner Group has been operating a wide range of raw material concessions across the Middle East and Africa, which are big money makers. In the press most recently is the monopoly that they've established over the diamond trade coming out of the Central African Republic. But they've got gold mines in Sudan, they've got oil concessions in Libya and Syria, and so on and so forth. So these oligarchs will feature prominently in the future in terms of that revenue uptake if we begin hitting the Russian economy the way we should. So I suggest that CENTCOM and AFRICOM have an opportunity by working with Ukrainian special forces to put a dent in these revenue streams. CENTCOM can certainly find and fix the commercial targets. What the Ukrainians do to finish them is their business. But you're going to have to press hard to get a reluctant White House to give you that kind of authority. Finally, I mentioned both the UAE and I mentioned oligarchs, and we will see a great deal of oligarch money flowing into Dubai and to Abu Dhabi, as London and Europe and the United States are increasingly inhospitable jurisdictions where our law enforcement agencies and our treasuries are first freezing and then seizing their assets. Again, an area where CENTCOM can contribute, even if it doesn't have the finishing force. We did this with the Afghan Threat Finance Cell together. In fact, I've got former Treasury officers here who know all about that. We did it again on my watch to ISIS together with CENTCOM. The all-source analytic capability that the command has, the planning methodologies that the command has, and the mill-to-mill contacts, these are all things that would help the interagency immensely. On China, I'm going to keep it very brief. Suffice to say that the Chinese Communist Party is watching what's happening, and they are reducing this all down to a math problem when it comes to Taiwan. What's the size of the hard currency reserves we have to have? How quickly will the Americans slap sanctions, and on what? They're not going to try to export control us because we don't export, we import. So what are they going to do in terms of raw material imports, these Americans and their European allies and their Asian allies? Given that the Russian ruble is one of the world's strongest performing currencies to date, even though the president came out saying he was going to, quote, reduce it to rubble right after the invasion, my guess is Xi Jinping has decided he can weather the financial sanctions. But to be on the safe side, the Chinese Communist Party is going to want as many financial entanglements as they can possibly engineer with Gulf financial institutions, preferably in yuan-denominated accounts, to deter the United States from sanctioning these gargantuan Chinese banks, banks that dwarf the size, frankly, of many U.S. investment banks and certainly Russian banks. On the export control side, I suspect the Chinese are a bit more concerned. As I said, they are a major importer, and so we should expect China to aggressively push for assured access to raw materials. In the event of a shooting match over Taiwan, China knows that one of our options is to enforce trade embargoes and blockades on the sea lanes. Through their contracts with the Saudis and Qatar and establishment of naval facilities in the UAE and Djibouti, Equatorial Guinea, and in Sri Lanka and so on, China is trying to reduce the viability of this option, and it will fall to CENTCOM to do the very best they can to keep this trade space open for a future administration. Finally, I mentioned Iran, and I'll conclude. They and their terror proxies are highly relevant, as we've heard today, both in the keynote speeches as well as through the panel. They're highly relevant to Russia's war. Now, the good news is I believe we are seeing the emergence of a full-scale revolution in Iran. And whether they can put it down through force or not remains to be seen. I hope I'm right and that they can't. This certainly has delayed and I think somewhat complicated their ability to further bolster Russia beyond what they've already done. But I mentioned that Russia's flush with cash, and there's no accident when they fly cargo planes into Tehran to onload these UAVs, these drones, and these ballistic missiles. They're also bringing in pallets of euros. It's no accident, like I said, that Iran has both the capacity and the willingness to sell these drones and these missile systems. It fits neatly into the Russian campaign of barbarism against the Ukrainian people. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. They're practicing genocide here. They're slaughtering innocent men, women, and children, civilians in Ukraine, and they're attempting to blot out the Ukrainian culture. And the Iranians certainly could care less. They're willing to go so far as put advisors on the ground in Crimea to both train on how to operate these drones, to fly them against civilian targets, and potentially to fly them themselves. We know they're there because the Ukrainian government has come out and said that recently they conducted a strike that killed as many as 10 of them. This is the same modus operandi that CENTCOM has seen the Iranians use with the Houthis in Yemen, who've been conducting drone and missile strikes against Riyadh, against the airport there, against civilian populations, against the Emiratis. It's the same MO that they've been using with Hezbollah, and perhaps now with the Maduro regime in Venezuela. So looking for opportunities to disrupt these actions in those cases has long been a CENTCOM priority. In fact, there was another Dow seizure just last week where they pulled over a vessel that was loaded with more explosives and ammunition and rocket propellant ingredients, as a case in point. But looking for ways to degrade Iranian drone and missile assistance to Russia, should become a major, fairly new priority. So with that, I'm going to conclude. I hope that you, I think you'll take away hopefully two things from my remarks. First is that CENTCOM, despite the shift to great power competition, CENTCOM remains unquestionably a vitally important command in this era of great power competition. But you're going to have to study up on domains that may not be as familiar or as comfortable for a combatant command, such as high finance, such as economics, such as the oil trade. By the way, this is something that I think the professors at USF can help with. In many cases, most in fact, you're not going to possess the finishing force or the effectors that are needed. Those are going to come from your interagency and coalition partners. But you can and should work to actively put them over the target. I think your second takeaway is probably that it would have been better if Elon Musk's AI had agreed to write this speech. But those are my thoughts as they stand, and I do thank you for the time and attention and the chance to be with you.
Our thanks again to Ambassador Marshall Billingsley, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute and former Special Presidential Envoy, for his remarks at the 6th Great Power Competition Conference at USF. To watch or listen to the rest of this conference, which focused on Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its implications for the central region, please check out our YouTube channel. The video has chapter markers so you can browse different sections to find particular discussions you're looking for. And be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and X, formerly known as Twitter. That's going to wrap up this episode of our GNSI podcast. Each episode will feature global and national security issues we found to be insightful, intriguing, fascinating, maybe controversial, but overall just worth talking about. I'm Jim Cardoso, and we'll see you at the boundary.